today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Friends, it is a painful thing to be broken of our pride, but it is a good thing. It is good. And I don't expect for a moment for Peter to be happy in verse 60. Matter of fact, he was probably never lower in his entire life than he was right then, and deservedly so. But friends, it's a good place to realize, God, you are so right, and I am so wrong, and the high opinion of myself that I once had, it's shattered.
Have you ever gotten a pride check from the Lord? In other words, have you ever had a moment where you weren't as strong or wise or faithful as you thought you were? We can all probably relate to Peter in this way. In today's teaching, Pastor David shares how Peter's denial of Christ was no doubt a painful thing for him to go through, but it was necessary. Being humbled by the Lord is heartbreaking, but it paves the way to forgiveness afterward. Don't wallow in self-pity. Let God restore you. Now, here's Pastor David with part one of his message, Witness of Jesus' Betrayer.
As we begin at verse 47 of Luke chapter 22 tonight, you need to understand that our text here begins with Jesus and the disciples. 11 of the disciples, Judas isn't there yet. He arrives in verse 47. There they are in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's a spring night, and the temperature would be somewhat temperate, wouldn't be terribly cold, sort of like California, spring night, you know, not freezing cold, but a little brisk in the air for sure if you're outside. Especially in the Jerusalem area, the elevation is a little bit higher. So, in our modern day, you know, it'd be like in the 50s, maybe the low 60s outside. It's a full moon because it's Passover time, and Passover always happens in a full moon. And there is Jesus, speaks with his disciples, and after he has poured out his heart and his soul in prayer, preparing himself for the trial that he is about to undergo, because he knows that in just a moment, it's going to begin. In just a moment, his great destiny that he came to the earth for, to die on that cross and to rise from the dead, the events that are going to knock over the first domino in that chain that's going to fulfill all these things, it's just about to happen. Matter of fact, if somebody was looking from the outside and was with Jesus at that point, they would see sort of a parade of torches coming across the Kidron Valley and back up the Mount of Olives to the Garden of Gethsemane. Those torches would be in the hand of a multitude that was there to arrest Jesus and take him away as a dangerous criminal. Verse 47, Luke chapter 22. And while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude. And he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? The multitude came, and we need to understand it wasn't just Judas. There was a lot of people in this group that came to arrest Jesus. In our modern parlance, we would say they called out the SWAT team. They brought a lot of people, a lot of force. They wanted to control the situation completely. There were, as we're going to read later on in verse 52, there were the captains of the temple, which was sort of the in-house security force of the Jewish temple. But as well as that, John chapter 18 tells us that there were also Roman soldiers in the group. Nothing was going to be left to chance. They wanted to keep this quiet. They didn't want it getting out of control. They wanted to do the very best they could to keep a lid on this and make it a quiet arrest. Therefore, they counted on Judas to draw close to Jesus and to kiss him, to identify the one that they were supposed to arrest. Because no doubt, the captains of the temple weren't fully familiar with Jesus, and it was nighttime, and there was a lot of people, and certainly the Roman soldiers weren't familiar with Jesus. It's not like they had a photograph of him in their hand. It's not like they had the artist's conception. They needed somebody to point him out and say, this is the guy. By the way, it also shows us that Jesus didn't walk around with those halos over his head. Otherwise, Judas would have said, no, just get the guy with a halo on his head, the light that shines behind him. No. No, it shows that Jesus was a very normal looking guy. He had to be identified. And how did Judas choose to identify him? You know, according to William Barclay, it was a very customary thing when a disciple met his beloved rabbi that he would lay his right hand on one shoulder, his left hand on the other shoulder, and draw himself close to him and kiss him. He said that this was the typical greeting that a disciple would give to his rabbi. And it's as if he comes to Jesus, and in this affectionate way, Judas comes to him and says, "Oh, you're my rabbi, you're my master, I am your disciple, I betray you with this kiss." And that's why Jesus says, verse 48, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" Of course, Jesus knew the irony beside this warm greeting. He essentially asked Judas this question: "Are you so dead to all feeling that you can kiss and betray at the same time?" I think you could say that right here, Judas is a tremendous example of a bad thing. Judas is an example of a seared conscience. The man who could go up and in the warmest of affection sign Jesus' death warrant, that's a cold-blooded man. But that's what Judas had given himself over to. Now, if I could just say this very quickly, what was Judas's motive? Many people have doing psychological profiles and such like this in Judas, try to figure out things. I'll tell you, there's only one motive that the Bible speaks of specifically. You might conjure up other motives. Maybe there are other motives involved. Many times when people do something for good or evil, they do it for many motives, not just one. But I'll tell you, the only motive that the Bible speaks about that motive that Judas did this for was greed, was money. He went to the priest and he said, "How much will you give me if I betray him to you?" That's a pretty heavy thing, don't you think? In any regard, the betrayal of Jesus was a terrible sin. And make no doubt about it, even though it fulfilled prophecy, Judas bore complete responsibility for it. Yet I must say this, and it's important for us to see it, that God, in his providence, he used the betrayal of Judas as being the best way to deliver Jesus to his fate. And what do I mean by the best way? Well, think of the alternatives. If they captured Jesus in a fight, or if they captured him while he ran and hid away, then it would have showed that Jesus was an unwilling victim of what he was about to undergo. Jesus didn't want to give that impression. If Jesus had surrendered himself, then it might have excused his murderers, or it might have been seen as a suicide. If it had happened accidentally, then it would have lessened the full effect of the bitter cup that Jesus was about to drink. No, and I like what Spurgeon said at this point. He said, "No, he must be betrayed by his friend that he may bear the utmost depths of suffering, and in that in every separate circumstance there may be a well of grief for him to bear." This was necessary. So Judas draws near, kisses Jesus on the cheek, and it's as if he says to all those arresting soldiers, the SWAT team, so to speak, "This is the guy. He's the one." Then what happens? Look at verse 49. "When those around him saw what was going to happen, they said to him, 'Lord, shall we strike with the sword?' And one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus answered and said, 'Permit even this.' And he touched his ear and healed him." Now, Luke is too polite to say it, but the Gospel of John identifies this swordsman as Peter. Did you notice Luke doesn't even tell us who it is? But Luke does tell us this. With a doctor's precision, he points out that it was the right ear of this person that was sliced off. Now look, I need to go off on just a bit of conjecture here, but I think it's somewhat reasonable conjecture. Picture this. If Peter was, as most everybody was in that culture, right-handed, because in those cultures, even if you weren't born right-handed, they had a tendency to make you right-handed. I'm not saying there were no left-handed people in ancient cultures, but much fewer because many people were trained out of their left-handedness. So let's just say it's probable that Peter was right-handed. If Peter's right-handed, he has a sword in his right hand. Well, do you realize that if you have a sword in your right hand and you're facing somebody, that it is almost impossible to cut off their right ear with a sword? Right? If you're face-to-face with them, you've got to deliver such a precision blow with that sword to on the opposite side of their head to slice off their ear. No, if the person's right in front of you, it's almost certain that you would slice off their left ear because that's the side that your arm's on. Unless, and this is what makes it very interesting as a conjecture, Peter attacked the guy from behind. Which, knowing Peter and knowing the circumstances and knowing the effect and knowing the response of Jesus, it's entirely likely. Here's Peter wielding the sword of the flesh, awkwardly doing his, he's a fisherman, he's not a soldier. You know, swinging behind a poor servant of the high priest, not even one of the soldiers. The Gospel of John tells that it was the servant of the high priest. Swinging the sword at a guy, not even facing him. It's the equivalent of shooting a man in the back. And what does Jesus do? He picks up that ear on the ground. He heals him, but not before he said this. Did you notice what he said? He said, "Permit even this." I think that's a poor translation. Jesus stopped this foolish and ineffective bloodshed by saying this, "Permit even this." I like what Marvin Pate, one of the commentators, says. He says, colloquially, we might render these words, "Stop it, no more of this." That's what Jesus intended to say. Not keep going, guys, with the swords. It was his way of saying, stop, stop with the sword play. Good one, Peter. You cut a guy's ear off from behind. Yeah, great soldiering right there. I'll fix your misapplication of the sword of the flesh and heal the man. Now, you know, just about 50 days from this, Jesus would have ascended to heaven and Peter would stand before a multitude on Pentecost and he would wield a completely different kind of sword, would he not? He would wield a sword of the Spirit. And those men who heard him on the day of Pentecost, some 3,000 who gave their lives to Jesus Christ, they would say, "We are pierced to the heart." That was the kind of sword business that Peter was called to do, not with the physical sword. So Jesus put the ear back on. He touched the ear. He healed him. Now verse 52. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the captains of the temple, and the elders who had come to him, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? While I was with you daily in the temple, you didn't try to seize me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness." Notice what Jesus says. He goes, "Really, guys, the SWAT team? Isn't this a little much? I'm one man. You see how great my security detail is? You know, they're like Barney Fife with the gun. They've got the swords. This is my security detail. Really, you need this to get me?" But then what he says, did you notice it? In verse 52, it's very powerful. "This is your hour and the power of darkness." Jesus explained why he went with them. He did not put up a fight because now was the time for Jesus to do or to allow to be done to him what they wanted to do all along, to arrest him and kill him. By all outward appearances, this was the hour when darkness was in control. This was the hour when darkness was doing its thing. But it's only in appearances. God is going to do his thing in the end. Look now, verse 54. "Having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. But Peter followed at a distance. Now, when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, 'This man was also with him.' But he denied him, saying, 'Woman, I do not know him.' After a little while, another saw him and said, 'You are also one of them.' But Peter said, 'Man, I am not.' Then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, 'Surely this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean.' But Peter said, 'Man, I do not know what you are saying.' Immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed." So what did they do? Verse 54 says very plainly, they led him and brought him to the high priest's house. Now, they brought him to the house of Caiaphas. There's a couple things you need to understand. This was not Jesus' first stop. When you put together all the accounts of Jesus' trials on that night, it's very interesting to see that essentially he had three trials before the Jewish authorities and he had three trials before the Roman authorities. Now, I'm using trials in a very loose way. I'm talking about appearances before people to judge him. His first appearance seems to be before the man named Ananias. Ananias was not officially the high priest, but everybody knew that he was the power behind the throne. That's why they brought him to Ananias' house first. And Ananias passed a quick judgment, take him to Caiaphas. They took him to the house of Caiaphas, and that's where Luke picks up the account. This was at night when Jesus was arrested. They led him and they brought him to the high priest's house. Now, this is what you need to understand. They're going to put Jesus on trial at night with a hastily gathered session of the Sanhedrin at the house of Caiaphas. Luke does not record the details of that nighttime trial. Matthew gives us the details of that trial. Luke will give us the details of the trial that happened at dawn at the same house of Caiaphas that was sort of the rubber stamp official, you know, veneer over this illegal nighttime trial. So they brought him to the house of Caiaphas, and while he's there, there's Peter following from afar. And by the way, I need to point out, archaeologists search around Jerusalem, of course, and try to figure out the sites of these things. And there's somewhat debate among archaeologists as to actually where the house of Caiaphas was. But there's some evidence to believe that it was at this place where many people call, they call it St. Peter's of the Cock Crowing. It's a monastery, and there's some old jail down there, and there's some things that are very interesting. But perhaps the most interesting there is a set of steps that date from before the time of Jesus. And it would be almost certain that if that place is the house that Jesus was headed, if that was Caiaphas' house, which is not absolutely certain, but there's a fair summation to be made, there's a case to be made for it, that Jesus would have walked on those exact steps. I mean, I'm not saying that those steps were on top of the steps. I'm saying those exact stones Jesus would have walked on that particular night. In any regard, there he is at that particular place, and it says in verse 54, but Peter followed from a distance. Now, I know it's easy for a preacher to go on that. You see, this is Peter's problem. He was following Jesus at a distance. And that's true. It would have been better if Peter would have been right alongside Jesus Christ saying, listen, I am this man's disciple. Whatever you do to him, do to me because I'm one with this guy. I am his. But you know what? Apparently, only one other of the disciples followed him even at a distance, and that was John. All the rest of them fled. So at least Peter was following at a distance. He was doing more than many of the other disciples. Yet, it was much more difficult for Peter to admit his association with Jesus when he followed him at a distance. Therefore, when he's warming himself around the fire, looking through the courtyard, seeing Jesus as they're sort of hastily gathering together whatever ad hoc group they can of the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, and he can see Jesus because he's concerned about Jesus. He wants to know what's going to happen to him. He wants to know if by some means he can do anything to help. He knows that he can't go through and be like a ninja and free Jesus. That's crazy. That can't happen. But I don't know, maybe there's something he can do, or maybe there's something he can learn. And as he sits among this group of servants and soldiers and common people around this fire in the middle of the night, did you notice what happened? A little servant girl interrogates Peter. I use the word interrogate in a joking sense. Because a little servant girl, a Girl Scout, comes along to Peter and says, hey, aren't you one of the guys that was with Jesus? What's Peter's response? Look at it here. Verse 57 says, but he denied him. He denied Jesus in at least three specific ways. First, in verse 57, it says he denied even knowing Jesus. Verse 57, woman, I do not know him. That's what he said to the Girl Scout. Then he denied being a follower of Jesus. Look at it here in verse 58. Man, I am not a follower of Jesus. Then finally, in verse 60, he's denying that he's even from Galilee. Man, I do not know what you are saying. You see, as is common in many places in the world, where you're from is betrayed by the way that you speak. And the Galileans had their own accent or dialect or this. And they could tell, well, look, you talk like a Galilean. It would be like somebody with a thick Texas drawl or, you know, a New England accent or something like that. And if Jesus was from Texas or New England, nobody get any ideas about that. But you say, well, of course you're one of his disciples. Look, you talk just like he would. You're from that area. And Peter denies. Isn't it funny? Think of a guy with a very thick Texas accent denying that he ever came from Texas. That's essentially what he's doing in verse 60, where he says, man, I do not even know what you're saying. And as soon as he does that, he does something else. Matthew chapter 26, verse 74 says this, that at the last denial, Peter began to even curse and swear. Look at it here, Matthew chapter 26, verse 74. Then he began to curse and swear, saying, I do not know the man. Well, you know what? If you want to distance yourself from Jesus, if you want to show to other people that you really don't know Jesus at all, cursing and swearing is a pretty good way to do it. It's a pretty good way to see, yeah, I don't even know the guy. I don't have any association with him. That's what Peter began to do. Now notice what happened at the end of it. What do we say? Immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And you know what? In that culture, in those kind of places, there's always, you know, chickens and roosters running around. It's the most common thing in the world to hear a rooster crow in the morning. Nothing unusual about that. Think about all the hundreds, maybe even thousands of mornings that Peter and others had heard a rooster crow. Think for everybody else around that fire. They heard a rooster crow. So what? What do you think it said to Peter when that rooster crowed? He remembered what Jesus had said. When Peter, in his tremendous self-confidence, said, Jesus, not only will I not deny you, I will die with you. And Jesus says to Peter, you're going to deny me so fast that the rooster's not even going to crow. The alarm clock's not even going to go off in the morning until you deny me three times. And instantly, Peter realized that all his talk, all his bragging, all his pride about what a great servant and devoted follower of Jesus was, it crumbled. Let me ask you right now, can you imagine how broken Peter is at verse 60? Can you imagine how shattered he is? But was he in a good place or a bad place? Friends, it is a painful thing to be broken of our pride, but it is a good thing. It is good. And I don't expect for a moment for Peter to be happy in verse 60. Matter of fact, he was probably never lower in his entire life than he was right then, and deservedly so. But friends, it's a good place to realize, God, you are so right, and I am so wrong, and the high opinion of myself that I once had, it's shattered. What a powerful thing that is. Verse 61, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. You want a great debating point? Which hurt Peter more, the sound of the cock crowing or the look of Jesus across the courtyard?
Well, that concludes the teaching portion of today's broadcast of Enduring Word with Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel of Santa Barbara. Join us next time as Pastor David continues teaching verse by verse through the book of Luke. Again, you've been listening to Enduring Word, the teaching ministry of Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California. You can learn a great deal about Enduring Word by visiting our website. The web address is enduringword.com. That's enduringword.com. You can listen to the rest of Pastor David's messages from the book of Luke, as well as other messages taught from God's Word right from the main menu. Simply click on Media at enduringword.com. Now, here's some important information about how you can visit Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Hi, this is Pastor David Guzik.
Thanks for listening to Enduring Word. I count it a privilege to share God's Word with you every day. If you live in the Santa Barbara area or will be just passing through, I'd like to personally invite you to join us for worship at Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara. We meet every Sunday morning at 9 and 11 a.m., and our midweek Bible study is every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. I'd love to meet you in person.
Thanks for that information, Pastor David. For more information, call us at 805-730-1400. That's 805-730-1400. Once again, you've been listening to Enduring Word with Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California, a listener-supported program. Please tune in next time as Pastor David continues teaching verse by verse through the book of Luke. That's next time on Enduring Word.